Welcome to the Conference on World Affairs. This session is being held at the Canyon Theater in Boulder Public Library. Today is Friday, April 12, 2019. The session is titled Vaccines, What You Don't Know Can Hurt Everyone. Panel number is 4606 and the time is 4:30 p.m. Our speakers today are Del Garcia, at the end of the table. She's Director of International Projects, Research and Development, Migraines Clinicians Network. We also have Moses Ma, Managing Partner at Future Lab Consulting, and Dr. Charlie van der Post, who is the Emeritus Professor of Medicine at University of North Carolina. I'll start off by giving a brief, extremely brief introduction of each speaker, and then each speaker has agreed to speak for about 8 minutes, starting with Moses. We will then move into a brief discussion period where the panelists will have an opportunity to address each other, and then we will have a Q&A session. In this session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, please select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your questions. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. So we have producers across the room. When you ask a question, please indicate if you are a student. Also on the app, it would be great if you can indicate your location. You probably have looked at the handbook and read each of our speakers' bios. I just want to briefly mention why each of our speakers has agreed to speak on this panel. Del Garcia mentioned to me that she's worked on migrant health issues and thinks of vaccination as a big, huge worldwide concern that needs to be addressed. Moses Ma will talk to us about his experience in Pakistan for a UNICEF project with respect to the polio vaccine. And Dr. Charlie van der Horst, who's a graduate of Harvard Medical School, an infectious disease specialist and internist who has worked in the U.S. and Africa doing research, care, and teaching. He is board certified in both internal medicine and infectious diseases, and he will also talk to us a little bit about the science of vaccines. So without further ado, let's begin with Moses.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, now you can.
Okay. So I'm not an expert on vaccines, but I do play one on television. And what I want to tell you about here are my experiences working in Pakistan and Somalia for the UNICEF organization. So so polio actually was doing really well, and then it spiked right after the bin Laden takedown. And the reason is the Taliban, the CIA gained access to the house by posing as medical workers. So in retaliation, they just killed some of them, you know. And even though it wasn't a polio thing, it was some other vaccine. It spiked. So they said, let's get some people who are really smart to figure out why at the ground level, right? So they invited a number of the larger consulting companies. And then when they told the senior partners that you'd have to hit the ground and get the ground truth, in Pakistan and Somalia, they all dropped out except us. Because I love adventure travel, and there's nothing more exciting than going to a country like Somalia or Pakistan. So just to give you an idea, the Mogadishu airport, no commercial aircraft are allowed there. And the only way in or out is on a UN relief flight. So when you land there, there's a crashed airplane right next to the runway. Right. And it's sort of like having a head on a stick saying, welcome to Somalia. And then in Karachi, which is a really lovely town, you know, has a great nightlife. But they said, you know, avoid these parts of the town. And this one meeting we had with a number of marketing people. You know, and the funny thing about marketing people is that they would show up in Armani suits and gold wristwatches in Pakistan, you know, and everyone's going, what are you doing? You know, look like you're poor. So anyway, one of them got kidnapped the day after our meeting, right? So it's actually kind of dangerous to go there. So what we did is we said we'll go because we really want to have an impact, and the only way to do that is to be courageous, to take a chance and to bet your life on helping the world. So we went in and we went to train stations and we just asked people, are you letting your children take the virus? And it's not injected, it's actually like 2 drops orally, right? So we, most people say, I don't want to talk to you. But eventually we found some. And the key to getting people to speak with you was to say the words, the magic words, Salam Alaikum. Mm-hmm. Right? So when you can connect, they would say, okay, I'll be open and tell you. So we were learning some really interesting things. For one, when we interviewed the polio workers themselves, one of the reasons they were really afraid of, like, the suggestion to just take a video of your mom saying that the vaccine was halal, because if you hold a smartphone in one of these villages, that's actually all you need to get shot, because there's a fatwa against anyone holding a smartphone, because you can use a smartphone to target a drone. So that wasn't, like, included in the equation. And then finally, I found this one family, and the matriarch was there with her grandkids. So I said, can you tell me if you're going to do this? She goes, yeah, we're not going to do it. And I said, thank you, because if any of you are anti-vaxxers, I thank you for being here, and please talk to us, because it's not about yelling and facts. It's about connecting at a human level and understanding your stories. So her story was, her son's a doctor and said, get the grandkids the vaccine. Her husband, the patriarch, said absolutely not, because he believed the rumor that George Bush had urinated in the culture. That was a fervent belief in that sector, and they wouldn't do that. After they debunked that one, it was that the culture was not halal, that it came from pork. So they had to make a video of imams in the Philippines saying, this is our factory, we actually bless everything, it's not from pork, it's from lamb. And then the final one was that we heard was, oh, they're putting this in to sterilize the population, which is like another conspiracy theory. But that they addressed by simply pointing to population records, but you couldn't use facts. What you had to do was tell people how many kids were born on that block. And then that allowed it to people, they had a personal experience. Oh yeah, 3 kids on our block had children, so maybe it's not. And they were immunized, so maybe it doesn't have that effect. So anyway, the thing I brought out of that was that when I spoke to these people who didn't want to get it, and actually the matriarch had a really amazing solution. She said, what I do is I tell my husband they weren't immunized, and I took half the kids and got them immunized for my son, right, and kept that secret. So it was like this really richly, socially rich solution that had to do with people and how they interact. And I was thinking, God, I should make a documentary of this, because this is so human. So I think that in the anti-vax story, it's the same kind of pain that we have to listen to and hear in order to be able to resolve this issue. Because I can tell you right now, studying the science, that herd immunity will collapse if enough people stop taking the vaccine. And then we'll actually have horrendous problems again. And this is science and it's fact. And if they can't hear the fact, you have to slow them down and then do this ethnographic enhanced listening and just have insight and empathy to hear their stories. And that's the only hope we have, is to be more human to solve it, not by banging people over the head with facts. So anyway, that's what I want to share with you guys.
Thank you. Hi, it's good to see you all again. So I'm Charlie Vanderhorst. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the science. So how do vaccines work? So there are different types of vaccines. There's killed vaccines, including influenza, polio, hepatitis A. There's live attenuated vaccines, so they're modified, so they're not as virulent. They don't cause serious problems. They just replicate themselves enough to generate an immune response in the body. And the most common one of that is measles, mumps, and rubella given to children. And Shingrix, which is the new shingles vaccine that adults should get at age 50 to prevent from getting shingles, which is an after effect of chickenpox. There are vaccines that are particular proteins or sugars. Hepatitis B vaccine is one. They're not live virus vaccines. They're just part of the bacteria or virus. Hepatitis B, HPV, the two bacteria that cause pneumonia and meningitis, Haemophilus and pneumococcal disease, and whooping cough, pertussis, there's also a protein or sugar. And then there's the toxin vaccines, tetanus and diphtheria. So that's the toxin that is made by the tetanus bacteria and the diphtheria bacteria, not the bacteria itself. And vaccines can stimulate one or both of the two major systems in the immune system that fight infections. So they're antibody-mediated defenses and cell-mediated defense. The one caveat, we don't give live virus vaccines to those with compromised immune systems, so people with advanced HIV, kidney transplant, liver transplant, heart transplants, pregnant women as well. Are vaccines perfect? No. It varies from vaccine type, but none are 100% effective. To prevent outbreaks, you need to vaccinate a sufficient number of people to prevent the spread from person to person. That's called herd immunity, as Moses said. So why did the anti-vax movement develop? So, you know, actually, I don't believe in them, but I try to think about why they did it. And I think one of the things that goes on is that with all the advances in science, there's still so much we don't know. But people want explanations for bad things that happen. So despite being a physician and a scientist, I can emphatically tell you, shit happens. Okay? You can live a perfect life, eat the perfect food, don't smoke or drink or use drugs, be virtuous in your practice, and still get a bad disease. The autism theory is largely based on a small study of 12 children that was published and then had to be retracted because it was fake news. And the guy, Andrew Wakefield, who published it in 1998, lost his medical license in England. So are vaccines beneficial? The impact of vaccines is enormous. Remember smallpox? No, you don't, because it's gone. Remember polio? No, it's almost gone. So the number of children under the age of 5 dying every year, mostly from preventable causes, has declined 28% from 90 deaths per 1,000 live births in 1990 to 65 per 1,000 in 2008. That is 10,000 fewer children under the age of 5 dying every day because of vaccines. Okay? There's some myths that have risen. That people use why they shouldn't get vaccines. So they say these diseases were disappearing prior to vaccines due to improved sanitation, housing, etc. Yes, that's true, but the drop in measles incidence coincided with the licensure and wide use of the measles vaccine beginning in 1963. Haemophilus influenza, the bacterial infection that caused the fatal meningitis in babies and immunocompromised adults, is another good example. That didn't come around until the early to mid-1990s, and we had very good sanitation and things then, but it dropped from 20,000 cases of meningitis due to Haemophilus in the United States to 1,400, and it's continuing to drop. And we've also seen the reverse. With the drop of vaccination, what's happened is so these viruses have come back and bacterial infections. So in Great Britain, a drop in the pertussis vaccination in 1974 was followed by an epidemic of more than 100,000 cases of pertussis and 36 deaths. In Japan, it dropped and there were went up to 13,000 cases and 41 deaths. In Sweden, it went they dropped as well, and it went to 3,200 cases there. Diphtheria in the Soviet Union, when they had a low primary immunization rate, they ended up with an outbreak of 50,000 cases and 1,700 deaths. So the other thing, myth, is that, well, the majority of people who get the disease have already been vaccinated. True, but this is the number, that no vaccine is perfect. So, for instance, the measles vaccine is 99% perfect. So you get the vaccine, you get immunity to measles. But it means also that 1% of people who get the vaccine won't be immune to measles. So if you have a school of 1,000 kids, and 10 kids, that means that 10 kids would not have mounted, who had been vaccinated, would not have mounted an immune antibody response. So if you have 5 kids who had no vaccine, and were exposed to measles in that school, they would get measles, plus the 10 kids who had been vaccinated but didn't mount an immune response. So 15 kids out of 1,000 would get measles. But that meant that 985 kids who had been vaccinated did not get measles. And otherwise, it would have been all of them would get measles because it's a highly respiratory darn contagious disease. So the other thing is there are myths that have arisen. So the other thing is the vaccines cause many harmful side effects. One of the things was that people were saying, well, the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine, often called DTaP, causes sudden infant death syndrome. So they did a study of that and actually found that kids who got DTaP were less likely to have sudden infant death. And we now know that most kids who get sudden infant death, it's the body position of what the baby was put on. It had nothing to do with vaccines. I've already talked about the other myth is vaccine-preventable diseases have been virtually eliminated from my country, so there's no need for my child to be vaccinated. And we've seen that in just this year, for the first 3 months, we decreased mumps vaccination that's gone down and almost eliminated the United States. We've had 426 cases. And do you guys know, I'm speaking specifically to guys, know what mumps does to men? It causes an inflammation of the testes and you become sterile. So a wonderful. It, 30%, that is, please don't interrupt me. It's my, I have the floor here now, okay? 30% of, I am giving you the truth, all right?
To hand out cards.
So, and we've been, and measles was eliminated in the United States in 2000, and we've had 465 cases of measles in 19 states in the first 3 months so far. It is one of the measles, just speaking a moment, is most, one of the leading vaccine-preventable diseases cause of death. In 1980, 2.6 million people died from measles. In 1990, after the with vaccination rates, it dropped to 545,000. And by 2014, the global vaccination program had reduced it to 73,000 people. So, and pertussis, we've talked about that. So, what is my thing, my takeaway message? We have to keep funding research. We need to ban all children from public, private, and charter schools who are not vaccinated. They are a danger. They are a danger to other children.
Not calling people names. We will be civil. I'm Dr. Hollingsworth. I am the head of CWA this year. We will be civil. I'm happy for everybody to give us their questions by app, or we've got a whole bunch of these. I'm happy to do that. But if we can't keep civil, if we're going to shout and scream, then it's over.
We want the truth, though.
It's
very
I hear you. And so.
Okay, everybody, let people like it, eh?
So, and I'm going to go further out there. I think that these unvaccinated kids should not be allowed in pediatricians' offices because of the children who are immunosuppressed are at risk of death. And I think that parents who don't vaccinate their children, if their child transmits a disease to an adult who's immunocompromised or another children, they should be prosecuted for murder. So I'll leave it at that.
Wow. So we have opportunities for folks to ask questions. I know there are a lot of questions. I have a lot of note cards in front of me. I will make sure we address all those questions. I would like to give Del about her time to speak her views on what she sees in migrant populations and working around the world. And then I will have the panelists address your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I think from my perspective, you know, Charlie has covered the science for me, and Moses has given an excellent example of where we see effective programs. And so when I looked broadly at the topic and what it was that I wanted to bring forward, I wanted to really try and address the whole issue that I see of being the conflict of common good. That what we're trying to also address is, if it was a singular issue that only affected the person without any kind of other effect elsewhere, then yes, absolutely. But when I look broadly at public health, I look at things like bicycle helmets and the fact that they are legislated or that there is statute or there is law, and people abide because they understand that the injury to themselves, to their children, is such that they don't want to see that happen. And so there is an understanding in many communities about the appropriateness of safety. And then there are the examples where a decision of common good has been made, such as seatbelt laws, and the fact that people abide by seatbelt laws, and the only person who can be hurt in that is generally the person in the collision. And I don't see parents allowing their children, you know, to flop around in cars like BBs in a boxcar. So if there was not an interest in protecting, then I would say, let's abandon all of them. Don't put them in a car seat. Scrap the helmet. But I think that the selective notion of protecting and not, okay, up to your parent. You do have parents who don't use them, who don't use car seats, who don't use seat belts. It seems unwise, but there you have it. But I want to return then to that whole issue of common good. And that if it only damages you or hurts you, there is your choice. But that if it has an impact elsewhere, then I think that we have laws, we have communities, because we want to live in communion with one another. We want to live in community with one another. And it appears to me that at that level then, because we choose to live in communities with others, that we have a responsibility to others. And that in that case then, if it were singularly only hurtful to us, that would be one thing. For it to have the potential to be hurtful elsewhere, then that, I think the decision is really very different. And I think we have laws, we have public health laws that are well researched from the idea that I don't want my child exposed. I mean, I've watched enough children die from vaccine preventable diseases. I don't ever want to see that again. It's been enough for me in this lifetime. My child is old. He will have no children. I don't have to worry about other children. But that does not mean that I don't worry about my friends and their children and their grandchildren. And we work a great deal to protect. And yet when we talk about some of these issues, you know, it's not taken up as an issue of protecting. But when you have someone who's been unvaccinated and they become ill, I think of just very recently the young man in the Northwest, that it became a case of pull out all the stops. Do everything to save my child. I don't care what it takes, what expense, what energy, save my child. And that child was saved by the very agent that he would have been given to protect him. And so it wasn't like something novel or additional was needed. I mean, other things were needed, but that one piece would have been given to him before, and we would not have had the effect that they were living through now without the urgency and without the fear of the child dying. And so I'm flummoxed. I'm flummoxed by a willingness to say, my community can bar no expense in saving my child, but I will not take an action to protect my child. And that's where I get lost. I don't know how we get to that point. Thank you.
Just based on the number of questions I've gotten, I think I'm going to diverge a little bit from what we had agreed on and address all these questions because a few of them have been repeated many times. I will address two of the questions that I can address personally. One of the questions that came in through the app is, why do you not have any anti-vax people on the panel? And that... Let's respect the group over here right now. We are all volunteers. We've been asked by the CWA group to come talk to you all. And so if you would like to make this request, I would say go back to the folks who are putting this panel together. Second question, have you ever received money from a pharmaceutical company? Yes, I work for pharmaceutical companies. I've worked for pharmaceutical companies my whole life. I will let the other panelists answer the question.
When I started getting NIH clinical grants, I stopped taking, which was 35 years ago, I stopped taking money from the pharmaceutical industry.
Hello. There you are. So, no, I've never taken money from a pharmaceutical company. But it doesn't mean I won't in the future. But the thing I want to add is that I actually want to commend everyone here for your passion. It's actually beautiful that you believe strongly in what you want and or what you believe in on both sides. And it's great, but all we need is not to shout and to keep an open mind and an open heart. Okay, the open mind on both sides, like including my friend here, right? So if someone has a test case of their child developing autism like a week after getting an inoculation, we should spend more money to understand that and make sure that isn't happening because we're not perfect. But on the other side, you have to keep your hearts open because when you believe so much, like those people in Pakistan, they were willing to let their kids get polio for their political beliefs. So you have to ask, is what I believe really for my child, or is it because it's part of my identity now, part of my psychology? So unlocking and unpacking that is really important for us as a culture.
And my response would be brief. I've never been offered a dollar, and I have no need to take the dollar, although I'm with you, Moses. I did think if they did a brand, a really great program, I'd be willing to consider it.
Okay, so let me start going through the questions, a lot of very specific questions. One common theme, and I'll ask Dr. Vanderhorst to address this, is what about the substances in vaccines? We hear about lead, aluminum, other toxins. Can you talk about the ingredients and the safety of the ingredients in vaccines?
You know, speaking in terms of general side effects, the most common thing, obviously, is from the adjuvants that's put in to boost the immune system, and they cause pain and soreness in the arm. Most of you have had that, or the butt for babies getting it. There used to be in the vaccines a preservative that was ethyl mercury, not the highly toxic other mercury, but a less toxic, easily peed out mercury called ethyl mercury. And that in 2002, I believe, was removed from most of the vaccines, including all of the childhood vaccines, because of concerns by parents, etc. But I don't know of anything else, and obviously we give this to thousands and thousands of people. I've had it, all the physicians I know, all our children have had it, our grandchildren have had it, and other than the sore arms and things. Now there are occasionally with the flu vaccine, you might remember those many, many years, so the old folks in the audience will remember we had the swine flu vaccine, and there was an increase in Guillain-Barré, which is an ascending paralysis, and that had an uptick after the flu vaccine, that particular swine flu vaccine, but we haven't seen that uptick again since then.
There's a card.
Let's use the system that we have, so there are notepads that we...
Write it on the card and give it to me. I'll make sure he does. Write it on a card and get it to me.
Let's switch gears a little bit. What Del said really, moved me in the social reason for why we should be vaccinated. Here's a good question for her. How much risk should I have to take in order to protect others when I have been injured by a vaccine, an injury that is on the vaccine insert?
So once injured, then the question is how much injury above that should be required or acceptable?
I think the question is, most vaccine inserts have a list of side effects.
Yes, potential. Uh-huh.
Side effects. So I think this person is asking, how much risk should I take, you know, in order to protect others? Because we're talking about herd immunity and how our taking the vaccine helps the herd develop immunity.
Right.
When there is potential for injury from the vaccine itself.
Right. And I think that when we talk about risk, and there's all manner of risks that we consider every day in our lives, and so if we want to focus only the risk on what is potentially a problem to you, and then how much of that you should absorb to be careful and protective of others, that's a difficult choice to presume. I think that we make those kinds of decisions all the time, though, in terms of a lot of common behaviors. And I think that the risk that we are willing to assume in protection of the group really can be quite high. And I think about it myself in terms of I want my community to be safe. I want the world to be a safe place, and so I am willing to go into very dangerous parts of the world to continue my work. And I'm willing to take that level of risk to make sure that those communities in the world are better. So personal risk is a difficult thing, but I think if we want to live in community and we want the world to be sound, then we owe it to our community to evaluate our risk and understand that we owe it to others.
So I'd like to add on just a couple things. Just for me, as a human being who gets vaccines and takes, I now take medicines, et cetera, that have side effects. So I'm on a statin, which is a drug to lower cholesterol, and I have, I think, a 14% risk of a stroke or a heart attack in 10 years, and because of my coronary calcium score, it's probably a 28% risk. Yet I'm also a pretty extreme athlete, and there is a risk, I think it was about 1% with a statin, that I can get potentially a fatal muscle destruction by the statin. And so I, you know, hesitated, but then I decided to take the drug because I didn't want to die of a stroke or a heart attack. Similarly, any unknown risk with the shingles vaccine. I've seen older folks get shingles who then develop a chronic pain syndrome who kill themselves because it's so awful and constant. So I was perfectly willing to take any unknown risk from the shingles vaccine to it. So I think we all make that decision. I think the hard thing is, of course, for parents as they think about their children. But as when I have two daughters now, 31 and 34, I vaccinate them because I've seen measles encephalitis. I've seen parents die of chicken pox. I've seen people die from liver cancer due to hepatitis B, cervical cancer due to HPV, and I've seen all that. So any unknown risk from the vaccine versus the defined risk of those diseases, I wanted them to be vaccinated. And I can tell you, if you go to Malawi, Africa, where I worked for 18 years, or South Africa, they have a 90% vaccination rate. Nothing is working in those countries. You can't get good medical care. That, you know, deliveries are still terrible. They're starving to death. The polluted water, cholera, horrible stuff. But they're not dying of vaccine-preventable diseases because they're getting, they know it's important.
Right.
I was, you want to ask that one? The one I was just handed to you?
This one?
Yeah.
This one?
You can answer that if you want. Aluminum.
Yeah, aluminum is a neurotoxin. So we're going to answer this one.
We need to talk. We can't hear you.
We'll read
okay,
it
Okay, I'll ask the question and then Moses will answer. Okay, aluminum is a neurotoxin that is in many vaccines. Hep B is given the day of birth, contains 250 micrograms of aluminum. Are you aware that there are no peer-reviewed studies proving it's safe to inject that amount of aluminum into a living being?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There are peer-reviewed studies, the randomized trials of the hepatitis B vaccine, where they look for the toxicity. The entire Chinese population in Vietnam, they're vaccinating all their babies because they know that those babies are going to get hepatitis B, grow up, develop cirrhosis and liver cancer, and that there is absolutely no basis that there's neurotoxicity from the aluminum in these vaccines.
Let me answer. So after this, we will post a number of studies and links that people can review because it's the science. We have to look at the science. So we will post links. No,
we're going to go with our process.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll.
So we'll, as Moses said, we'll follow up with links. I'm not sure how that's done, but we'll do that.
Okay. Make it so.
Perfect. So I think there's a common theme. There's a common theme among the questions that I would like the panelists to address. There's a theme that says that no double-blind study, placebo-controlled studies have been done, especially for DTaP or MMR.
It's just not true.
There's the theme about the peer-reviewed articles for toxins. So this sort of ties in with the manufacturer's liability and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation. So I would love to hear your comments on peer-reviewed studies, what's the process for getting vaccines approved, and we'll sort of tie that in into the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act. So I will come to that question. Let me first address the question about double-blind placebo studies and peer-reviewed publications on vaccines.
I'm sorry, he's the scientist. You're going to have to take this one.
But I'm sorry, I missed that. I was.
Okay, so the question is: Have studies been done? Double-blind placebo studies for DTaP and MMR. And studies have been done that the placebo doesn't have the same toxins as the vaccine.
I don't know. I mean, all these vaccines, the vaccines aren't approved until they're given to patients and they're followed and make sure that they mount an antibody response, or if it's a cell-mediated immune vaccine of a live attenuated vaccine to develop a cellular immunity, they're given and the patients are followed.
We're going to go our process.
Okay, so I'll do this question. Are you familiar with the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, which removed all liability from vaccine manufacturers involving vaccine injuries? Since that time, $4 billion in compensation has been awarded when Health and Human Services says is 19% of injuries.
1%.
Is 1% of injuries. So, would you? I do read a lot about the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act. I myself don't understand it. So, if there's anyone on the panel that can talk to it, that would be great.
I mean, I know about it. Do you know about it? So, yeah, this was set up not to absolve manufacturers, but so that they wouldn't drop. The problem was is that the manufacturers were dropping out of making life-saving vaccines. And so this was passed for two reasons. It was passed for patients who said they had had an injury that they could get compensated. It's basically an insurance policy for people who get the vaccines. So if they... ma'am, I know...
You asked the question and you asked for an answer. Please let him answer and then we'll go on to the next question. It's not... No, because that was not the process.
So anyway, so that's the way it was set up.
So I do have a comment in here. If the audience members are disrupted, the CWA faculty director has told us that he's going to shut down this panel. So there's a lot of information that's being provided over here. So it would be great if we can follow the process and have the panelists answer your questions. This was not set up to be a back and forth, so I will just let the panelists answer the questions that are given up to me and stop when there's folks in the audience speaking. I would appreciate folks from the audience.
Where's the question with the audience?
So while he's looking that up, I just wanted to talk about an observation. I'm noticing that when something about science-y happens, there's audience clapping, and then the ones who aren't clapping are obviously having issues with the vaccine. But I'm also looking at body language of people. Like, there's a lot of frustration, like no one's hearing me, stuff like that. And I'm saying that this is not a forum for interaction, because this was set up as a panel. I love interaction. If we had it differently, I would just have an entire one-on-one session to find out what's going on and to understand what people's stories are and your pain. Because obviously, if you're having a problem with vaccines, something happened in your life that's making you very upset, and no one's listening to you. And there needs to be a forum for that, but that's not this forum. This forum was simply like a panel, and panels are not perfect. Okay?
I got the aluminum one.
Go ahead. Go. Aluminum. We'll do aluminum.
Okay, so there was the question I'm going to go back to. The question was, aluminum is a neurotoxin that is in many vaccines. Hepatitis B, given the day of birth, contains 250 micrograms of aluminum. Are you aware that there is no single peer-reviewed study, et cetera, et cetera? So the key issue, and this is why it's important to know the facts. So aluminum is given as an adjuvant to boost the immune response, and it's in many vaccines. It's also in various food products, baby formulas, etc., including, and so the total amount of, well, infants receive about 4.4 milligrams, so not micrograms, of aluminum in the first 6 months of life from vaccines. They receive more than that in their diet. Breastfed infants digest about 7 milligrams. Formula-fed infants ingest about 38 milligrams. And infants who are fed soy formula ingest about 117 milligrams of aluminum during the first 6 months of life. So we get a ton of aluminum in our regular diet, and certainly not less than what we get in the vaccines. And aluminum's been highly studied by the Center for Biologics and Evaluation of Research before it can be used as an adjuvant in these vaccines. And we're continuing to develop new vaccines for HIV using various adjuvants, including aluminum, which works very well.
So there's a follow-up to that. Injection and ingestion, which is injection versus oral, are totally different.
No, I disagree. I'm sorry, I disagree with you on that.
I have a funny story about injection versus ingestion. In Pakistan, the culture is that they trust doctors and injection more. So when they switched to the two-drop trivalent, it actually dropped down. People don't want to take drops. But then the minute the doctor shows up with a syringe needle, everyone's rolling up their sleeves. I mean, literally, in Pakistan, it's just really like a different culture. So I just want to say that it's a cultural issue. I don't know the science on that. But the important thing here is that we have to agree on truth and science. So let's find peer-reviewed studies and bet our lives on that. Because we're literally betting our lives on the stuff.
So I want to follow up on Dr. Menrovos when he commented about the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act. I understand why that act was put in place, but there's a number of $4 million that's floated around. I've seen it in other places, that is compensation that given under this act, $4 billion have been awarded to humans for 1% of injuries. What do you think of this number, and why do you think the amount is so high?
I don't know that figure. I'd have to look it up, and sorry, I can't answer that question.
Okay.
So I have a response to that. So I work a lot with post offices. So how much can you sue a post office for losing a package? So because it's a universal service and they're trying to help everybody, the government said, if people were able to sue you, you wouldn't be in business. So they limited it to $50. You can't sue the post office for more than $50 because they're providing a universal service. So this is a trade-off that happens. You know, how many billions of dollars could be sued for lost packages or late packages? It's probably $1 trillion by now. But this is happening Because it's not a perfect world, they have to come to some kind of agreement where they limit liabilities for things that are considered to be scientifically proven. That's all I wanted to add.
So my next question is for Del. Is there a parallel between mistrust of this science, I guess vaccine science, and distrust of the science of human-caused climate change?
Wow.
I think that the only point of comparison and connection that I can see is what Moses has been pointing to, is a sincere and continued willingness to discount the facts and to discount the science. And so the similarity that I see on both of those sides is, irrespective of the science, if it is not meeting the beliefs of the individual, then the individual is willing to set the science aside. And I see that in issues of health. I see it in issues like a vaccine. And I do see it in issues of climate change. And I think all of the research on beliefs and decision making also indicate that no matter how many facts you give people, the more facts you give them, the more dug in they get in their own opinion, contrary to the facts. So that it's not facts that improve people's understandings of what's going on. If they want to believe something, they will believe it, and no amount of fact-giving is going to change that belief. And so I think Moses' position in terms of trying to understand is an important thing, is a place that I wish I could get to. I think the urgency that I feel is that we're talking large numbers of people. I'm talking huge numbers of people. I'm not talking six families that are unhappy. I'm talking thousands and thousands and thousands of children whose lives, I believe, are as valuable as anyone else's, and I want to see them protected.
What I wanted to add is that you should actually look at the belief, the persistent belief that certain things aren't true and that my position is true as a mind virus, right? So you have to ask, am I afflicted with this? I ask myself that all the time, you know, is this position right? So the only thing I can bet on are peer-reviewed studies, right? So I actually read scientific journals a lot. So I wanted to suggest that, you know, ask yourself, am I really, you know, am I believing in this more because of something I would need to believe or because it's the actual science? If there's any glimmer of openness to your position, then my work is done here, because all we want to do is just open the minds of a few people who've kind of shut it down. Because what you have at risk here is, it isn't just, you know, I actually believe that polio and measles are our tests by humanity to see how we survive, because when a true pandemic shows up, if you still have that belief that I won't take this virus, it could actually cost 1 million lives.
So I just went onto the website of the injury prevention thing, and the insurance company. So in the last 30 years, you are correct, $4.1 billion was given out for 6,465 claims. That's about one injury per million doses of vaccine.
No. One per million.
1% is 1 of 100. 0.1% is 1 of 1,000. Okay, and 1 million is 0.01%. Please.
I
don't know where you went to school, lady, but that's the
minimum. Ooh.
Okay.
We're not having that conversation.
I would like to follow up with a question for Moses. I think I'm very interested in this, in sort of how do you get folks to understand your view, right? So the question over here is, how do we help bolder families understand that vaccines can be congruent with a natural, clean lifestyle? How do we help people understand what is not and what is vaccine injury?
I don't have all the answers, but I'm going to tell you that... Yes, it is on. So I want to tell you that this vaccine issue is actually an incredible opportunity for us to learn how to do this. So what it requires is both sides learning how to loosen up, because how many of the people who don't like vaccines kind of don't like Mr. Trump? Yeah. So we're polarized as a country, and we're actually polarized as a world. And we have to learn how to get beyond that, because if we're going to have like this wonderful collective intelligence and unified, you know, global one world stuff, we're going to have to start agreeing on stuff to move forward. So this is an opportunity for us to listen to you and for you to listen to us. Unfortunately, this is a panel discussion. We don't have that perfect opportunity, but I welcome the CWA trying to invent a new kind of event or format that we can experiment with that in. But I think that it would be great to figure this out as an example. But you're going to let us have to have a little win here, right? You're going to have to say, okay, I'll listen to you. I'll look at the peer review, and you might be able to change my mind. If you come saying, you're never going to change my mind because I know I'm right, then you have to wonder, am I really that open?
So I think this is a great opportunity for me to read this question that says, please share about the vaccine bill and the hearing in Denver. I'm not going to read out the dates and times and location because I'm not sure if they're accurate, but there is a vaccine bill in Colorado that's going up before the legislature. There are hearings for that, which is definitely a different venue than today's venue. Moving on, I would like to ask Dr. Van der Ross to address this other question that's come up often. Why do we have so many vaccines? The sheer number of vaccines we're giving our newborns compared to just 20 years ago, why so many in so much such young bodies? Why not over longer? Why not over longer periods of time?
So I understand that question, and because the science has advanced that we know now how to prevent more diseases, and for instance, now we're giving the Haemophilus B conjugated bacterial vaccine, which we didn't have then. We have the rotavirus vaccine in Africa, which we didn't have then. And so we now have a meningococcal vaccine for college students. We have the HPV vaccine, which we didn't have for adults, and hepatitis B, of course, which we didn't have. So the reason we give it is because they work and they're saving lives. That's why we do it. And we wouldn't do it if we don't do it willy-nilly. We've made Haemophilus meningitis disappear. Students in medical school now, it's hard to teach about Haemophilus meningitis because they don't see it. Whereas I saw it all the time, babies dying or being left with mental retardation or hearing loss due to that. And now we're seeing the same with pneumococcal meningitis and with the elderly who are getting it as well with the conjugated pneumococcal vaccine, which I hope all you older folks have gotten. It used to be called the old man's peaceful death, pneumococcal pneumonia, but that's gone. So that's why we give it, and there's no evidence. Your babies are exposed to more antigens every day than many more than they get in the vaccines, through food, through the environment, etc. And one of the interesting things is, when I was developing my breastfeeding study for Malawi, this was 2 decades ago, the issue, we were going to give the mothers a weaning food called Plumpy Nut that had basically peanuts, groundnuts they call them in Africa. And someone here in the United States mentions, well, what about peanut allergies? And I said, I don't know. So I, you know, met with my colleagues in Africa. I said, do you see any peanut allergies? And he said, no. No kid gets peanut allergies. And why? Because they're exposed to it as an antigen very early in life. All the allergies and things we see in the United States, they don't see in Africa because they're exposed to all these, you know, the dirt and things like that. We've cleaned up everything. Our houses are sterile. Kids don't go play outside and get exposed to all these antigens and bugs and dirt and plants and things like that. So then those kids have many more allergic responses and asthma and skin rashes than they do in Africa. I can guarantee you about that.
So Another question, more on the public policy side. I'll have Del address this question.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Okay. What does the panel think of the move to limit unvaccinated children from public spaces in New York? Knowing Boulder is such a pocket, should we plan for a similar outcome when the inevitable outbreak lands in town?
You know, he's tired. Let me answer something. And what I'll do is I'll share like an interesting story for you, okay, just to give him a rest. Okay, so I'm not like a vaccine guy, although I do have like some vaccine research projects in IT. But, God, it's getting kind of late. I need some more coffee. So, did I use up enough time? Are you ready to go now?
Was to me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You male, thank you.
I'm so sorry.
You know, the prospect of limiting children's participation is really hard to contemplate. But I think when you really consider what those spaces are like, where there is a sharing of surfaces, a sharing of items, you know, touch and play and proximity and shared airspace. And I know how infectious measles are, then I do understand what they're trying to do in New York because they do have a lot of children. And I think additionally what we don't consider is that in schools now, with every effort being made to make sure that the schools are available to children with particular issues, illnesses, and concerns, the effort is to integrate them and make sure that the schools are as inclusive as possible. But that what that now means then is that in many of these venues, you have children who are immune compromised or who are in a position to be made quite ill. And I think that I owe it to them, and I think we all owe it to them in our communities, to not endanger them unnecessarily. So again, we get back to my point of, if I want to make a choice for my family and my children, and it only affects me, that's one thing. If it's really clear that what I do has an effect elsewhere, then I have to be responsible to my community, or I don't have to live in community. If I wanted to go off the grid and live alone, that would be a thing too. But we do live in shared spaces. We do have our children in shared environments. And so we share the good, but then if we're not careful, we share the bad. And I don't think that that's appropriate.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap up with the last question. And this is, I'm sorry, Dr. Vanderbilt.
Oh,
this is for you. This is for you. Has the anti-vax movement, and this is a student question, has the anti-vax movement impacted the medical school curriculum? Are medical students being prepared to effectively explain to parents and patients why vaccines are so critical?
That is a really, really good question. And I think, you know, part of the problem, what's been going on, is that if you go on, you know, physicians were, you know, we're not 40-hour week people, okay? We work closer to 70 to 80 hours a week. And so we're really, really busy, and you get 15 minutes per patient. And so it's really, and we don't have time to go on social media and do it. So if you Google on vaccines, very slick, beautiful things with movie stars, etc., pop up. And they have really persuasive arguments, and it's hard to argue, and it takes time, as you can see just here with me. And I consider myself a pretty smart person, but I have to go look up the injury vaccine, what are the numbers in terms of, yes, it was 4.1 billion, etc., etc. So, you know, it just takes a lot of time. So I don't know that we're doing an effective job of doing that, because mainly because we don't have the time. But I think it is crucial that we do so, so we can make sure that these epidemics, these new recurring epidemics, stop.
That's it.